Well, my friends, come on back in. I think we have lost a few of our companions, but we have still another half hour to really plunge into the life of the Benedictine path. And while you're all gathering back in, let me just let you know a little bit about next week. We are going to look forward to the Reverend David Moore, who returns to our podium here to explore chapters 9 and 10, Fostering Well-Being Through Building Trust and Community. And if you remember David Moore, he's a bit of a barn burner and an absolute prophet of connectedness and a new community. I think he's going to be a wonderful speaker for us. The snacks for body and soul next week will be brought by the White Group. And we want to thank this week's group for the yummy fruit, to our authors for the extraordinary desserts. We have had a real sweet tooth party out there. And I think there are some to take home with you if any of you would like some. So by all means, do that. Thank you so much. It was wonderful. Well, we're going to bring Adam back up to the podium. We want to thank him for sharing the remarkable knowledge that he has of a lifetime with the Benedictine rule and the timeless teaching that that ancient tradition translates into for us today. I love his insistence on context, because that is the shell that holds the egg out of which we are always hatching in every era and in every day. So back to Adam for any questions and answers, and I believe he has a few more comments he'd like to make for the last half hour. Thank you, Adam.
As Pat was saying that, I was tempted to make bird sounds escaping from the egg, but from the shell. I think I'll not inflict that on you. Questions? I urge you to come to the microphone so everybody, or comments, or as one professor of mine in college used to do, he used to put his glasses down here, he'd look out and say, questions, comments, miscellaneous personal abuse.
Not really a question, but maybe it is. Early on in my life, one of the big things that changed me, I think, was reading Thomas Merton's Seven Story Mountain. I think learning about the lives of people, their bios, and how God entered their life at a certain time was really powerful for me as a young person. After that, I read the Confessions of St. Augustine, another one that was very, very powerful. So I really just want to say, you know, books can really change us. But whatever.
That's true, and especially if they're about people's lives. They're Augustine, you know. I don't think we often understand how significant some things are. I tried to say a bit of this about the Rule of Benedict, but Augustine, we know more about the inner life of St. Augustine than any other living human being from that era. It's astonishing. But everyone else is much more opaque to us, and yet he opens this light on his whole life, messy as it was. Thank you.
Bearing in mind I'm not familiar with the Rules of Benedict, but I wanted to know if the book itself and you currently in your life practice silence in the form of centering prayer, resting in God, like the way Keating taught. Do you have such a practice in your prayer?
I don't currently myself do it, but I did at one point. I think what he is trying to get people to do is very simple at the center. It's just quiet down, find a still point, and allow that then to be the dominant part of your life at that moment. And I think all meditative prayer partakes of the essentials of the Center in Prayer movement. I find him and Esther DeWall and Judith Valente and so many people now so interesting. Historically, the spirituality movement, which is now so large and owes so much to Thomas Keating and other people like him, really didn't begin until after the 60s. And so that you can really almost trace an arc of interest in spirituality in general. And I have the feeling that, at least from the point of view of selling books and people being hired to do programs and general cultural interest, that sort of hit a plateau. And I don't know why that is. I think part of it was that American Christianity for a very long time didn't have very much of that in it at all. And then the great discoveries of Merton and Keating and other people and their teaching and their practices opened up many hearts. And I think there's not a diminishing of that now, but it's not the dynamic thing in the front of people's religious experience and consciousness at the moment. We as monks are devoted to silence, and we all follow different paths on that. I myself have become interested in desert father spirituality, and in particular the teachings of a man named Evagrius Ponticus, who is the intellectual forebear behind John Cashin, and is actually the theoretician at the base of all Western Christian spirituality. Evagrius Ponticus, Evagrius. Evagrius. Many friends of mine have a t-shirt that says something about heretics, and then it lists all these famous, wonderful people who are heretics. And I'm happy to say he was a heretic. In the mid-5th century, he was judged to be off the reservation on several issues, together with Origen, but nevertheless. But I think anyone who's seriously interested in spirituality has to begin to encounter that personally, and I think one of the finest places to start with that is centering prayer. And not least because it's very organized. There's a movement, there's a kind of, people are taught how to run the experience, there are the books, there are the tapes, there are all of the modern contemporary ways of communicating that practice. And it's amazing where you find it. It's still going strong in a lot of places. But I don't know if that addresses that or not, but yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There are, we have quite a lot of non-Christian meditation groups that use our facility. Most of them are Buddhist of one sort or another. And the continuing need for teaching and practice in this area is enormous. And it's, I think, centering prayer is one of the ways in which the Christian approach to that has been brought to the fore. And it's kind of marketing of it is, I think, a very healthy thing, because without good marketing, most Americans don't pay attention to things. So. Thank you.
I hope this is not too audacious. But I was shocked, even though I already knew it, that you were closing on Calgary. And I would like to ask if you would share with us whatever you feel that would be both good for you and good for us on the death and dying that you are experiencing there. The college that I graduated from, Ursuline College, closed in August. Mm-hmm. And I know what that did to me. And they're here, mm-hmm. my neighbor, we go to St. Anthony's. It died. And I think I would like that input from you, if you're willing to share your, I guess, reveries on dying.
Oh, thank you, I guess. we belong to a larger organization called the Order of the Holy Cross. It's the oldest and largest monastic community for men in the Episcopal Church. We began in 1881. And over the years, we've had many, many different ministries. We founded schools, and we've just turned over the latest one we founded to a more self-perpetuating board in South Africa. We've had monasteries all over, and they begin and they end. This one began in 1947, which is a long time ago. It's 71 years ago, I guess. And it has morphed over the years from one thing to another. Initially, retreats were not sort of useful social events to get people out of town to concentrate on the subject, which is kind of what the business world uses them for. They were supposed to be life-changing events. And in those days, men and women didn't have them together. That's why St. Mary's was founded, so that the women would have a place to go in Santa Barbara, as well as the men up where we were, up above Gibraltar Road. And over the years, that began to change from intense personal self-evaluation and into kind of general spirituality, growth times for church people, and then for parishes, and then gradually that opened up to 12-step, and thank God for 12-step, or we would have left a long time ago. They were the economic mainstay for us for years. But and other groups like that, and then along come the yoga people and the meditation people, and the ministry we've pursued has changed over the years. And I was chatting with somebody earlier, Casa de Maria is closed. The mission no longer has its very extensive retreat center. what used to be the Vincentian place, St. Mary's, up on the ridge below where we were, is gone. Now we're going. I don't know if there were others. There probably were. One by one. What is this? I don't know. I think there's something cultural going on. I know our particular case is about aging. We have 30-some members, and only 6 of them in North America are under the age of 60. Yeah. Well, I used to be one of them. I mean, I didn't think this was a problem, but that was 12 years ago. So, you know, monasteries don't exist for their ministries. The ministries grow out of the life of the monastery. And when the monastery begins to serve the ministry, then you have to ask the question, why? You know, the ministry is worth doing, but is this what these people should be spending their working lives pursuing? And the second question to that is, even if the answer is yes, and clearly here the answer is yes, it's worth doing, but then the question is the community able to do it? And the answer is no. I mean, we have 3 people. A few years we had 4. Ago we had 4. We had 5. One of them died. You know, it's just... So part of it is facing reality about ourselves. And I think that's the biggest part of it. I was hoping at one point that we could build better, more appropriate space for ourselves where we are now. And we discovered that for all kinds of good reasons, the city of Santa Barbara's process for building anything is so complicated. And we're in the middle of an archaeological zone, which is unbelievable. We can hardly plant a turnip without a study. I'm not joking. Well, I'm joking about the turnip, but the thing is, the turnips wouldn't last. You know, we also have gophers. Anyway, here are the rabbits, here are the gophers. It does have its funny side. But we really can't keep on doing it. Because we need a community of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 people. And we don't have it. And then it came as a shock to me. I grew up in the West. Came as a shock to me to learn that there are young people from the eastern part of the United States or the Midwest who don't want to come to California. They don't like California. So, but do we all like New York? I mean, so it's a two-edged sword. Yeah, I am very sad. I've devoted most of my life to this in one way or another, my working life, and I personally, emotionally, I'm very involved in this. I understand, however, that we have to take care of our older members, and that we cannot do that and run this. And then the other side of that, unfortunately, is the economic side. This is our asset. And I don't know if you've ever paid for nursing care for somebody, but it's just not organized in a way that people can afford to do it, and yet we have to do it. So we have to have that component as well. So I'm sorry that it's happening, and I know the enormous goodwill for us in this community. Every time I turn around now, they think they're helping me by being sympathetic. Oh, it's such a shame. And I say, well, yes, it is, but, you know, this is the 83rd time I've heard this week. But it's true. It's every time it's true, and every 83 times it's true. But there it is. And I'm sorry that the mission has morphed. I'm sorry that Mother Nature destroyed the Casa de Maria. I'm sorry that the Marian Vincentian Fathers up the hill made that decision. I'm sorry that this is happening to us. And I don't know, it's a mystery to me that this is all kind of coming at a single period in time when we think that the needs are so great, but then somehow the means to meet them are being withdrawn. And that, I just can't, I don't quite understand that. So. Renee, you're the one with the beautiful gray hair.
The Viking warrior relative. DNA to prove it. Yeah, one of the most devastating things that happened to us, we live in Mission Canyon and we have a direct view.
Oh, yes.
And to sit there and watch that.
Yeah.
It was just devastating. We've never gotten over the loss of Mount Calvary. And that was such an asset to the whole community. You guys did amazing work up there. Great loss. Let's see. But I wanted to thank you for your incredible explanation of the prodigal son. I have never heard it explained that way in the cultural context and what it means to the family. Now, I have a prodigal son, and he just came back last week because he was completely broke.
That'll do it.
Yeah, he had no money. He had to come home, and he hasn't spoken to his father in over a year and a half. So that gave us a lot of hope, and you helped me understand, you know, the healing and what that means when the father welcomes the prodigal son. Now, my son started out. He became addicted to meth, and his employer down in Malibu would give it to him to make him work harder at the job that he had. And I went to visit him in Malibu, and he would sleep with a gun under his pillow. And his twin sister had a problem with suicide. She started cutting herself when she was 12. So after a number of years, his twin sister would say, "I'm too tired. I can't be here anymore." So I turned to the deliverance ministry in the Catholic Church, and they had a conference down in Anaheim, and they brought back this Catholic who, Father McNutt, and he'd married a nun, and so he was kind of thrown out, but they brought back the deliverance ministry, and I went down to try to get my children healed, and they explained that sometimes suicidal is generational, and I said, yeah, everybody on my mother's side and on my father's side have either shot themselves in the head or hung themselves in the barn or drank alcohol and killed themselves that way. So they prayed over my children, and a month later, my daughter, who said she's too tired to be here, she says, "I just love myself. I love my life. I love myself." And so I never told my kids what I did for them. But my prodigal son went from, he stopped doing meth, but he became the head of the biggest marijuana dispensary in Los Angeles, in which they have to have, like, armed guards to protect it and stuff. And then he became a pot grower in Northern California. And so luckily the police came and he had to come home. And then after a while, he decided that he needed to go to law school because his sister was in law school. So he went to law school, worked for his father full-time in his law office, went to law school, and got his law degree. And the week he got his law degree, he verbally attacked his father so badly that none of my other children will tell me the things he said. And that's what turned him into the real prodigal son, in which he wasn't allowed was banned from every house in the family and wasn't allowed and just, but anyway, thank you so much for helping me understand and validating, you know, what we've been through and how transformative it can be and how healing and how getting your children back no matter what path they've taken is the most amazing feeling and the most amazing trust in God and prayer. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that. Amen.
When I was a little girl in Sunday school, the image that stayed with me all my life was Jacob's ladder. But I saw, in those days, I only saw the angels ascending, and I thought, how wonderful it is. There's a ladder. We can all get there. But later on, I began, as I read the Bible and studied it more, I saw that they are not only ascending, but descending, and it's a continual circle of comings and goings. And that's the only explanation I can find for this disappearance of all our spiritual centers, that something is changing and something will come down again to take its place, because things are always moving and we won't be left with a void forever. And that's the piece of hope I carry in my heart.
Thank you.
Father, I just wanted to add that Father has written a summary of the closing that you are going to go through, and it looks like you're going to be here for the whole next year.
We are.
And so I have that copy on the current event table, a copy of your letter of how you're going to go about closing. Sadly,
when it was clear in our meeting that that's the direction it was going, I, for personal reasons, wasn't in very good shape either. But when the smaller group got together to decide how to do this, I needed to point out to them that we had contractual obligations through 2020. And sometimes the use of legal formulas is helpful. So we were fully booked through 2020. We're going to step down in stages from January 1st, 2021 until Easter, which is in early April that year. And then we'll be completely closed at that point. And our goal is to have moved everything we need to move and be ready ourselves to go. Now, how that plays against the eternal game of real estate, I don't know. But I will do my best to control it.
Father, since we only have one copy, I just had a request. Do you have a link to that letter that you wrote?
No, it isn't in that form online.
I'll just make some copies.
Oh, okay, that would be good. Yeah, but that's all in there, and our superior's gracious words about why we're having to do it. So. Well, thank you. This has been a wonderful time for me.
What a wonderful morning. And thinking of Jackie's final offering, I think that we often leave church with Christ is risen. Christ will come again. I believe that that is the core of the spirit of the ever-presence of God in whatever form. We know that we are held in an enormous, evolving pattern of presence, and we just have to trust it for you, for us, no matter how much we're going to miss you. May I just say that we have found one book that belongs to one of you that was left behind last time, full of little notes at the back. You may recognize it from my description, and we'll put it up on the current event table. So we will see you next week with David Moore, and again, our profound thanks to Father Adam McCoy.